Hello, and welcome to the European segment of our 2025 proxy season wrap-up podcast covering continental Europe and the UK today. I'm joined by Emanuele Sicilesi from our Southern European research team, Loic Gilhan de Merksem from our French research team, and Micah Abelana from our UK research team. We'll also build upon our environmental and social coverage from the Americas segment with Victoria Everard, a member of our global ENS specialist team based in Brussels, who will add on ENS trends beyond what we've already covered for the US and Canada to focus on Europe and a few other markets as in Asia as well. By the way, Mark Goldstein in the Asian section of this podcast will also touch on ENS trends specifically for Japan in our separate Asia segment. But back to Europe, and I'll talk with Emanuele first. Hello and welcome, Emanuele. Market competitiveness has been a top political and economic agenda in many European countries. The European Commission has initiated the so-called Omnibus Bill with the aim of reducing the administrative burden of regulation on companies in particular, and the regulatory process is still ongoing, with or without new updates. You'll maybe tell us. At our May halftime bulletin report podcast, we also talked about the banking sector and the tangible activity with various proposals to consolidate banking groups in Italy. So actually, let's start with the European banking consolidation. What is the latest on the M&A activity from and in the banking sector in Italy? And I believe you will have an update from Spain as well.
Hello, Georgina. With all Italian general meetings held, it appears we are back at the potential stalemate situation that existed in Italy at the beginning of this year. Let me first take a step back and summarize the state of play last year. It all started in September 2024 when UniCredit, one of the main Italian financial institutions, announced the acquisition of a significant stake in the German bank Commerzbank. A few months later, UniCredit made another significant move by launching a voluntary public exchange offer for all shares of the smaller Italian financial institution, Banco BPM. Just before that announcement, Banco BPM had announced the launch of a tender offer on the Italian asset manager Anima Holding. The momentum kept building with MPS, Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena, the oldest Italian active bank, launching an unexpected public exchange offer on the larger player Mediobanca, aiming to create the third largest banking group in Italy, alongside Intesa Sanpaolo and UniCredit. Amid this consolidation wave, BPerBanca decided to launch an exchange offer on its rival, Banca Popolare di Sondrio, and Banca Ifis launched a tender and exchange offer for illimity Bank. The latest move in this banking consolidation saga came from Mediobanca, which in April launched an exchange offer on Banca Generali. This brings us to the most recent developments. Although almost 100% of UniCredit shareholders attending the AGM held in March expressed their support in favor of the capital increase to serve the takeover bid for BPM, the company CEO Andrea Orcel warned that there's a high chance that they would not proceed with the operation at the current stage due to the conditions set by the Italian government. Regarding MPS, the results of the general meeting held on April 17 showed a less significant support for the exchange offer. Although the resolution on the capital increase to serve the operations of the planned consolidated bank reached sufficient level of support, a large group of international institutional shareholders expressed their dissent. Lastly, at Mediobanca, the board has decided to postpone its general meeting for the approval of the voluntary public exchange offer for Banca Generali. The justification for the postponement is linked to the ongoing evaluation process of the operation on Banca Generali, initiated by Assicurazioni Generali, which is the major controlling shareholder for Banca Generali. In the meantime, Spain's competition watchdog CNMC approved the proposed acquisition of Banco Sabadell by its larger competitor, BBVA. However, the much-anticipated merger is now also subject to political decision-making in Spain, with the most recent news from June 24 that the Spanish government put restrictive conditions to any potential merger, undermining the industrial logic. Further complicating the issue is that Sabadell announced it is considering selling its UK subsidiary, TSB. So overall, while various intra and cross-border M&A attempts are being made in Europe to consolidate banking groups, in practice, alignment of interests in the European landscape has proven challenging.
It certainly has. Thanks, Emanuele. Quite a complex web of various powers at play, particularly in Italy. Another recurring issue in parts of continental Europe remains the format of general meetings, i.e. in person versus virtual versus hybrid. Again, Italy first. Last year, Italian companies continued the COVID era practice of holding their general meetings behind literally closed doors with no possibility of shareholders attending in any way. And in Germany, virtual only meetings remained common practice. What have you observed this year?
Shareholder meeting participation in Italy has been quite peculiar in last years. During the COVID pandemic, Italian companies were temporarily allowed to forgo physical shareholder participation at the general meeting by designating an exclusive proxy holder. Subsequently, the introduction of the capital markets law in 2024 allowed issuers to amend their bylaws to allow the permanent restriction of shareholder participation only and exclusively through a company designated proxy. The new law on the meeting format has led 2/3 of Italian issuers opting for closed-door general meetings during the 2025 proxy season. Meanwhile, in Germany, as anticipated in pre-season predictions, many companies opted to request shareholder approval to convene virtual-only general meetings. Nearly 150 companies proposed reauthorizations for virtual-only AGMs. Most companies limited their authorizations to 2 years, after which they will have to come back for further shareholder approval, while very few, 11, limited their authorizations to extraordinary circumstances only. Nevertheless, multiple German companies, particularly those who have remained with virtual-only meetings since 2020, have promised to host at least one of their next 2 AGMs in person, quelling some shareholder backlash that they had remained virtual-only since prior to the pandemic for no good reason.
Thanks for those updates. And next, executive compensation remains one of the topics that can attract the most significant shareholder dissent. What updates do you have for us on this front?
Across the continent, we have seen increases in both CEO pay opportunities and pay outcomes. While for the banks, this is probably linked to the positive financial results registered in the last few years, the increases in the industrial sector are not as clearly linked, and most likely the results of a generally prolonged period of unaltered pay packages in recent years following the COVID pandemic. As mentioned in our previous bulletins, at the European level, we observed many proposals to increase pay. These increases not only relate to scheduled adjustments, but many companies have also updated their benchmarking practices, and a significant number is increasingly looking to US peers because of pay and hiring competitiveness concerns.
Thanks, Emanuele. Let me now welcome Loic Guilhand from our French research team into the discussion to look at some of the key issues and trends in France this year. Welcome, Loic. Remuneration is always a high-profile issue in France as well, which usually sees some of the highest overall levels of dissent on pay in Europe. So why don't we start there? What key trends did you and the team observe on the topic of remuneration this year?
Hi, Georgina. During this last part of the French season, we witnessed a slight increase in dissent from minority shareholders on executive remuneration elements, both for remuneration reports and remuneration policies. For this analysis, we reviewed the disclosed vote results of all the widely held French companies that had their general meetings between the end of April until mid-June, a total of 85 companies. And we considered shareholder dissent to be significant when at least 20% of shareholders voted against or abstained on a remuneration-related vote. Out of the 85 companies we reviewed, 39% had a significant shareholder dissent of at least 20%, an increase of 4% over a similar analysis for 2024, measurable although not large. So we conclude that the level of concerns linked to poor remuneration practices remains meaningful although relatively stable. Significant dissent can be seen, for example, to be linked to the CEO salary increases without compelling rational or unbalanced and poorly explained peers for benchmarking selection. In fact, some companies select in their panel of peers for pay benchmarking companies that are not obviously comparable and without explanation. L'Oréal is a good example of this practice. With a 15% pay raise as part of its CEO's 2025 remuneration, the company justified the increase on the grounds that its remuneration is lower overall than that of its peers. However, L'Oréal's peer panel is in part made up of American companies which have different remuneration practices to those in France. At its 2025 general meeting, the CEO's remuneration policy was adopted but received dissent of around 12%, even though only 43% of the company's shares are considered free float. The dissent of the minority or outside shareholders is therefore likely to have been even more significant. Other companies, such as Schneider Electric, had to deal with significant dissent as well. In Schneider Electric's case, the company sought to approve the former CEO's termination payments that raised concern as to its quantum and the triggering event. As a result, the approval of the termination package of the former CEO received 31% votes against. Of the 85 companies we reviewed, 30 had already faced significant shareholder dissent on at least one remuneration resolution last year, and only five of these appeared to have been responsive. This lack of responsiveness on the part of some companies may have therefore contributed to the higher rates of dissent. It may also be interesting to note that 22 companies in the 85 we considered had received significant dissent on remuneration for at least two prior years in a row. As a reminder, the French Global Remuneration Report on executive and non-executive corporate officers reinforces the French say on pay framework by allowing shareholders an overall vote on the company's remuneration practices. The vote on this item is therefore a relevant measure of whether or not shareholders are dissatisfied with the company's practices overall. A look at the votes this year on Global Remuneration Report proposals show that 37% saw an increase in dissent, with an average increase of only 2.5% in against votes. Investors' dissent in voting appears to be largely limited to specific remuneration elements and has not yet so much impacted the global report votes. It will be interesting to follow the evolution of dissent votes at French companies and investors' reaction for next season.
Thanks, Loic. And aside from the pay matters, are you seeing any other trends, particularly in relation to recent regulatory changes related to market competitiveness that we've talked about earlier?
Yes, absolutely. During the latter part of 2025 French proxy season, we continue to monitor the application of the new provisions and the impact of the 2024 so-called attractiveness law in France. Particularly interesting was the introduction or extension in company bylaws of the ability to act through written consultation of the members of the board, which is becoming a widespread practice. Since 2024, French law no longer confines the matters upon which the board can take decisions through written consultation of the board, and pretty much any subject can now be the topic of a written consultation on an opt-out basis, fully at the discretion of board members. Looking at the same 85 companies we reviewed for their remuneration voting trends, 74% of the companies that proposed a bylaw amendment proposed to introduce or extend the possibilities of written consultations. ISS will monitor future changes in disclosure practices in this area in light of the bylaw changes adopted this year.
Thanks, Loic. And finally, in terms of, say, on climate votes in France, and not to steal Victoria's thunder in her section in a few minutes, have there been any changes this season that you want to note?
Yes, I won't go into too much details on these points, as Victoria will talk more about it in a few minutes. However, there are a few points that can provide for the French market. Since 2021, 21 French companies in total have submitted a say on climate voting item. In the 2025 season, 8 French companies have done so. Companies have some different practices in this area. Some of them present a plan every year, for example, Amundi, while others propose a vote on developments and progress after every 3 years of the plan, for example, Engie. In 2025, the following new companies presented their first say on climate voting item to shareholders: OVH, LNA Santé, and Société Foncière Lyonnaise, breaking the pool of French issuers that have ever given a say on climate proposal to 24. Of the 3 new companies this year, 2, LNA Santé and Société Foncière Lyonnaise, are smaller companies, which contrasts with the rest of the pool. As of 2025, Total Energy has decided to drop its annual consultative say on climate vote and announced it will seek shareholder approval only in the event of a significant change in its strategy. Instead, pursuant to the AFEP-MEDEF recommendation to present the climate strategy to shareholders, Total Energy has chosen to present a non-voting item relating to its 2025 sustainability and climate progress report. 9 other companies, French companies, have also chosen to present a non-voting say on climate item in 2025. This practice has developed since 2023 and seems to be getting established. It will be interesting to follow its evolution in future years.
Thank you, Loic. And let me next bring in Mika Abelana from our UK team to the discussion. Mika, welcome. I know that the UK's AGM season is long and actually still ongoing through June and July, but at least the first half of the UK proxy season has come to a close and many companies with December year ends have held their AGMs by now. Are there any general observations on the voting results so far to start with?
Thank you, Georgina. Yes, we have been looking at vote outcomes on remuneration items, since this is where recent regulatory updates as well as emerging market trends this year have focused. So far, we've seen more dissent or against votes on remuneration reports, which breaks the trend of declining dissent on remuneration reports overall in recent years. In contrast, on remuneration policy votes, there have been fewer cases of significant dissent recorded this year, with material being judged as more than 20% dissent.
Was there any pattern you saw to the types of remuneration report proposals that receive significant dissent?
Interestingly, there isn't any one pattern that we can discern here, looking at the overall picture at this stage. For example, dissent in the 3 companies where remuneration reports failed to pass, those being Melrose Industries, XP Power, and Plus 500, appear to be for different possible reasons. But there are a few with common threads, like at Centrica and Balfour Beatty, which received 40% and almost 30% votes against, respectively, with remuneration reports that proposed significant salary increases for executive directors. But there were also 2 companies that sought exceptional LTIPs and or one-off awards, that's Inchcape and Direct Line, that recorded 35.5% and 36.5% of against votes cast on their respective remuneration reports.
And how about for the forward-looking remuneration policy approvals? At the start of the year, I know our team were expecting a lot of changes on pay policy structures this year.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we have seen a handful of companies proposing a new remuneration policy ahead of the normal triennial approval cycle to propose material changes in their pay framework. And we've certainly observed that proposals for hybrid LTIP plans, which combine performance-based shares with time-based or restricted share elements, have increased this year. This type of award scheme remains unusual in the UK market for board-level participants, but UK companies with significant exposure to the US, where of course restricted shares are more commonly used to incentivize management, have been increasingly putting forward hybrid LTIPs. Most of these plans have been quite contentious, So far, 7 companies which featured hybrid plans received significant levels of dissent of over 20% on their remuneration policies. Those companies are Convatec Group, Intercontinental Hotels Group, Haworth Group, Computer Center, TIPA ICAP, Harbor Energy, and Diversified Energy. The dissent levels recorded were between 21 and 33%, although no such proposal has been voted down to date.
In connection with UK companies' US exposure, one of the main themes in the UK market recently has been international pay competitive with peers, especially with US companies. You mentioned hybrid plans. How else are UK companies making the case for pay increases and pay competitiveness?
Definitely, pay compression and talent recruitment or retention in a wider scale are some arguments that we encounter more and more, even in the context of companies making no changes in pay structure at present, but proposing material changes in the future headroom available. And this is the case for GSK and BAE Systems, just to name two, where the US markets alone contribute up to half of their total sales. The US arguments made by both companies are also supported by strategic rationales and good performance though, and dissent recorded on the remuneration policy votes were less than 10%, indicating many investors understood and agreed with their arguments. Also relevant are 4 UK banks, HSBC, NatWest, Barclays, and Standard Chartered, which have all cited competitiveness for the global talent pool in their remuneration policy submissions this year. However, this was also in the context of rebalancing pay components in light of the removal of the previous banker's bonus cap. And Lloyds is the only major UK bank to defer structural pay changes until its 2026 AGM.
Thanks. And aside from that removal of regulatory bonus caps for banks, have there been any other changes in regulations or best practice guidelines that may impact UK companies' future practices and reporting?
Most recently, we've got the updated UK Stewardship Code by the Financial Reporting Council, or the FRC, which was published earlier this month. And this will come into force from January 1st, 2026. And then the other ones are those we already covered in past sessions, like the Irish Corporate Governance Code by Euronext Dublin, which took effect from January this year, and the updated QCA code for smaller companies, which came into effect for financial years commencing on or after 1st April 2024. This expands the requirements for smaller UK companies to put forward remuneration reports and remuneration policies similar to the main market UK companies. On the latter, so far, around half of AIM companies that we cover for clients have indicated their intention to comply with the QCA code for the ensuing year. And we've seen a few companies putting forward their remuneration report and or policies for the first time ahead of the effective date. We certainly expect more to come in the second half of the year.
Thank you, Micah. And very interesting to hear on those UK developments this year. Let me now bring in Victoria Everard to look at the more global topic of climate change proposals, which are largely happening outside the US, mostly in Europe and in Canada, and also to take a look at ENS shareholder proposals more widely. Welcome, Victoria. Can you give us an overview of what you've seen this year on proposals related to climate change?
Thanks, Georgina. We're still processing the data, but we're able to draw 2 key findings from the main proxy season so far. First, management's eye on climate proposals are not becoming much more widespread. And second, shareholders have tabled fewer climate-related proposals overall so far this year, not just in the US. Regarding management's eye on climate proposals, we've seen 21 proposals across Europe since January, including 4 first-time submitters, Italian Telecom Infrastructure, Inuit, and 3 French companies, Small Caps, Alena Santé, Société Foncière Lyonnaise, and OVH Group. France remains the market with the most say on climate proposals, 8 in 2025, followed by the UK with 3. 4 more proposals are expected in the UK through mid-July. This number is similar to the 23 ASEAN climate proposals recorded in each of the last couple of years. All but one company this year, the exception was Santos, received more than 80% support. However, when considering free float votes, six other companies are considered to have not passed the 80% threshold. These were namely Altarea, Amundi, Carmila, Equinor, Gestamp, and Inuit. French real estate company ICAD remains the sole company to have offered a separate say on biodiversity vote.
And are there any noticeable new trends to highlight in the say on climate vote proposals themselves? I know they can vary.
Yeah, in the last year, we've observed a subtle but significant trend emerge. Several major companies are stepping back from their previous commitments on the frequency of their say on climate votes. It started with Shell and Glencore in the UK, both announcing last year they would no longer present an annual progress vote and move instead to a three-year vote on their climate strategy, or an earlier vote for Glencore if there are material changes in its business. This year, despite a significant change in its climate strategy, although it was alluded to in 2022, BP has not offered a say on climate vote to its shareholders, claiming it wasn't in their best interests. Dutch NGO followed this, launched a campaign calling on shareholders to oppose the re-election of board chair Helge Lund for this reason. And over 20% did, despite Lund announcing his departure earlier, following pressure from the New York hedge fund, Elliott, to focus BP on traditional energy assets. Total Energy was also expected to give its annual vote this year, but decided to present a vote again only in the event of a significant strategic change, stating that following engagement with shareholders, the board found the annual vote superfluous. Equinor did submit its say on climate vote after 3 years. Its strategic update to increase near-term oil and gas production to meet global demand was backed by 71.5% of minority shareholders. Outside the oil and gas sector, Metal and Mining, Anglo-American, postponed its say on climate vote to 2026 as it is working on simplifying its portfolio, which will significantly change its emissions profile. In the UK, two utilities also halted giving annual say on climate votes. SSE opted for a three-year cycle instead, and Severn Trent is reconsidering its approach based on market practice and stakeholder feedback.
An interesting update. Thanks, Victoria. And how about climate-related shareholder proposals? What are you seeing on that front?
Well, the number of climate-related shareholder proposals outside the US dropped slightly to 47 in 32 companies so far this year, versus 54 proposals at the same period last year. As in the last couple of years, the majority of them were tabled in Canada, 21, and in Japan, 18. The financial sector remains the most targeted. In Canada, Minority Shareholder Association, MIDAC, continues pushing for say on climate votes at major banks and two insurance companies. Also, similar to their US peers, BMO, CIBC, and TD Bank in Canada were requested to disclose a clean energy supply financing ratio for the second consecutive year. The latter obtained more than 30% support, a record high in Canada markets since 2020. Meanwhile, Japanese and Nordic banks received proposals on their fossil fuel financing and climate risk oversight. Symbolically, 2025 was the first year in nearly a decade that activist NGO followed this did not table any resolution in an oil and gas general meeting, citing investor reluctance to use their voting power for this category of proposals. They called it a strategic pause to get more investors on board and discuss how to better uphold shareholder rights. Still, some shareholders challenge Equinor's and Shell's respective strategies. At Equinor, several institutional investors filed a shareholder proposal asking the company to assess if its strategic shift was consistent with the Norwegian state and Equinor majority shareholders' expectation on climate change. This proposal was supported by 16.6% of the minority shareholders. At Shell, several shareholders put forward a proposal challenging the consistency between Shell's LNG growth strategy and its climate commitments, garnering support from 20% of voting shares. Outside climate-related matters, in the UK, NGO ShareAction resumed its living wage campaign originally launched at retailer Sainsbury in 2022 and targeted this year three other big retailers, Next, GD Sports, and Marks & Spencer. At Next, the resolution was supported by 20% of shareholders. In Canada, five more banks were targeted by the MEDAC to report on the measures to prevent forced labor and child labor in their lending portfolios. The resolutions received between 20 to 30%.
Thank you, Victoria, and also thanks to Emanuele, Loic, and Mika. This concludes our coverage in this section of our June podcast. See you in another segment soon.